Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences and our live stream audience. It's my great pleasure to welcome tonight Tony Platt. He is a distinguished affiliated scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of numerous books on criminal justice. And I was delighted when I found out he had another book on this topic because we bring this topic up often here at the club over the last decade or so. What we're doing in our criminal justice system really does need to be rethought. So welcome, Tony Platt. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I'm glad to be here. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me here to talk about this new book. Beyond These Walls is the title. That comes from a couplet that Eugene Debs wrote when he was in prison in the 1920s for his labor and political activities. And the whole couplet was, "Behind these walls, sweet freedom calls." So that's sort of a theme that runs through here, though the freedom calling ends up being somewhat faint these days. The subtitle of the book is Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. So I'm going to try to be provocative today and try to raise some issues for rethinking. Hopefully you'll agree with everything that I'm going to ask you to rethink, but at least want to be engaged in the issues that I'm going to talk about. So to start with, the injustices of the American criminal justice system are longstanding and by no means unique to the Trump administration. They consist of macho policing that is routinely indifferent to human rights in impoverished communities and reduces citizens and residents to objects of fear and loathing, astonishing cruelties that characterize day-to-day life in jails and prisons, including widespread use of solitary confinement and sensory deprivation, sometimes for decades, in violation of international human rights standards, and taken for granted institutionalized racism that confirms the widespread prejudice that people of color are the most criminal, the most dangerous, and the most deserving of ostracism and distrust. The numbers tell us part of the story. The police today routinely kill about 3 people every day, as far as we know. It's a disgrace that the United States does not require police departments to report on deaths in custody or deaths during an arrest. So we have to rely on the media, we have to rely on nonprofit organizations and individuals. But for the last 20 years, we've had pretty good reporting on this, and we know that it's about 3 a day. That may not seem a lot, but if you consider that's about 1,000 a year, and in the 20th century, that would be minimally 100,000 people killed by the police. 99% of these people killed are poor. They're disproportionately African-American, Latino, Native American, and disproportionately mentally ill. And that many more than 3 a day, we know, in times of exceptional repression in the history of the United States, and those exceptional moments are not so exceptional. A deep history teaches us, for example, that the police were deeply implicated as participants and collaborators in lynching that went from really the defeat of Reconstruction in the mid-19th century way into the 20th century, implicated as participants and collaborators in lynching that took place, and then doing their best to hold back the civil rights movement for decades. After World War I, for example, J. Edgar Hoover, who headed the FBI for a long, long time, after World War I, he blamed the African-American press for promoting what he called defiantly assertive ideas about the Negro's fitness for self-government, a position that he took for decades while heading the FBI, even encouraging in the 1960s, encouraging Martin Luther King to commit suicide, sending him anonymous notes, telling him that he should really kill himself. And what was important about the FBI's role in terms of their position on African-American equality and the civil rights movement is that they sent a message to all the local and state police departments to follow these ways of thinking about African-Americans. And so that I know that it's somewhat popular these days to say that we need to fight for reform of criminal justice system at the local level. You know, it's not really a national issue. But in the book, I argue that, in fact, the actions of the police on the local level are really the standards for what they do are set at the national level. And if for decades you have police leadership in the FBI and other national agencies talking about and proclaiming that black people are dangerous, that they're somehow different from other human beings, that they cause trouble, that they're defiant and so on, then local police departments act upon that. So this went far beyond early part of the 20th century. It went well into the latter part of the 20th century. In 1951, for example, the Civil Rights Congress petitioned the United Nations for relief from what it called, in their words, acts of genocide against the Negro people. Once the classic method of lynching was the rope, now it's the policeman's bullet. That was 1951. And here's James Baldwin, I think one of the most brilliant observers of American urban life and race. Here's James Baldwin writing in the 1960s. He said that he hardly knew anybody in Harlem, from the most circumspect church member to the most shiftless adolescent, who does not have a long tale to tell of police incompetence, police injustice, or police brutality. That's the 1960s. And then, of course, for the last decade, we've had the same issues being raised by Black Lives Matter and other organizations. So this, indeed, is a long tale to tell. The problem of police violence, I think, is endemic and systemic. It's not easily solved, and it certainly can't be solved by cosmetic interventions like multicultural training and body cameras, which apparently have made no difference to the levels of police violence. And I have some sympathy for the police here being targeted when there is a big publicity about a case that happens, when they're caught in the spotlight, so to speak. And then reformers come along and say, oh, you need to go through multicultural training, you need to deal with your unconscious racism, you need to wear body cameras and so on. On the other hand, we're going to put you in military kinds of uniforms. We're going to arm you to the teeth. We're going to make you be as distant as possible from the people that you're policing in the communities by putting a barrier between you and the people through your cars, through your uniforms, through the way you look and so on. We're going to tell you that those communities you police are profoundly dangerous and not to be trusted. And then we're going to give you multicultural training on top of that. So my sympathy goes to police on the rank and file when they're being blamed for the problems that I think are systemic. Policing in the United States, in my view, has always been militarized, combative, and undemocratic. There was never good old days when the friendly urban police walked local neighborhoods that they knew personally and made crime reduction a priority. Here's an early important police reformer in the early part of the 20th century, August Vollmer, who used to be the police chief of Berkeley and then went on to lead police reforms around the country. Here he is writing sometime probably in the 1910s or 20s. He says, "We're conducting a war against the enemies of society, and we must never forget that." So this notion of the police as sort of a military operation or a semi-military operation, I think, is embedded in the earliest days of professionalization. So then what happens to the arrested? On a daily basis today, close to 7 million people are in jail and prison or on probation and parole every single day. The numbers are staggering, I think, but they mean nothing without context. So let me give you some context for that. 31 American states have the highest incarceration rate in the world. They work out the incarceration rate, that is the number of people who are in prison for every 100,000 people in the community. So it's higher than Turkmenistan, a Central Asian country identified by Human Rights Watch as having one of the world's most repressive regimes. And 38 American states lock up a larger proportion of their residents than does El Salvador, a country recovering from a civil war and dealing with one of the highest homicide rates in the world. And it takes close to 5 million workers to do the policing and guarding at a cost unknown billions. I spent a lot of time for this book trying to figure out how many people work in for criminal justice and what does it cost. I was able to figure out how many work in it, but trying to figure out what it costs is almost impossible. And the book, if you go to the appendix, explains like why this became such a difficult challenge. I used Rumsfeld's famous comment about the unknown unknown. You know, there's some things that we know, there's some things that we know we don't know, and there are some unknown things that we don't even know that we don't know. So, and I think that last one is more accurately captures the problems of trying to figure out the cost. Anyway, we have close to 5 million workers doing policing and guarding. And again, to put this in context, the United States has more criminal justice employees than teachers. We have more guards than doctors. And police outnumber social workers by almost 5 to 1. So that's the context that's more important than the numbers. And so what do we get for this extraordinary investment of people, money, and resources? Not crime control, for sure. I think the so-called criminal justice system is neither about crime control nor about justice. And it's certainly not a system. It's totally chaotic. A better descriptive term might be the criminal injustice chaos than criminal justice system. First, the police, I think, have never been effective at reducing social harm. Law enforcement and crime control are really not their forte. The best way to reduce our chances of victimization, and many of you know this, is to learn techniques of what in the profession is called target hardening, making ourselves a harder target to be victimized. And if you can afford it, buy an insurance policy and create a defensible space around your home, burglar alarms, high-tech surveillance systems, bolted doors, guard dogs, razor wire, gated walls, depending on what you can afford. The police even acknowledge their impotence when they advise us to organize neighborhood watches, look out for suspicious folks, and if you're a woman, carry a whistle and mace, take classes in martial arts, stay off the streets after dark. In other words, take personal responsibility and good luck. So no wonder then that most people do not even report most crime to the police. Secondly, I don't think the criminal justice system has anything to do with justice. Its injustices work both externally and internally. Let me start with what I mean by externally. Baggy pants and a barbecue in the front yard can get you jail time if you live in a place like Ferguson, Missouri, while laundering profits for a Mexican cartel that was implicated in thousands and thousands of murders gets you a fine equivalent to 4 weeks of profits if you are the global bank HSBC. And it was James Comey, the same James Comey, who helped HSBC to recover from the scandal when he was a corporate lawyer in between his government jobs, a topic he conveniently avoids in his self-righteous memoir. Being in the wrong place at the wrong time can get you stopped, frisked, and arrested, as the Baltimore police did to about 250,000 mostly black residents from 2010 to 2015, while engaging in systematic corporate fraud against millions of clients, as Wells Fargo did in 2016, resulted in resignations, firing of low-level bank employees that had nothing to do with the decisions, and fines that were more than triply compensated by the Trump administration's tax cuts. No executive did any time. Or buying and selling drugs on the street can get you a lot of time, but only probation if you are the executives of Purdue Pharma, the company that triggered the opioid crisis by misinforming doctors about the dangers of a drug that contributes to the death of about 145 people a day. This time it was Rudy Giuliani, Trump's current mouthpiece, that helped Purdue avoid time. And if you've done time for a felony, like at least 5 million people have in this country, you're mostly banned from voting. But if you're Don Blankenship, CEO of a mine in West Virginia that killed 20 workers a year after the U.S. Department of Labor cited his company for 500 safety violations, you do 1 year in a minimum security federal prison, and then you run for the U.S. Senate on a platform that berated the Obama administration's occupational health and safety regulations. It is so rare to see a rich or famous person incarcerated that when it happens, it receives massive media attention. You might recall, for example, the case of Congressman Anthony Weiner. Or is it Weiner, you know? Both ways, this is not a good name for this man. The case of Congressman Anthony Weiner, who received a 21-month sentence for sending sexual texts to a 15-year-old girl. So that's the way it works externally. That is, some people don't even get into the criminal justice system. They're diverted long before there's a chance that they're going to go to jail or prison. And the way it works internally is through what W.B. Du Bois and his famous book, The Souls of Black Folk, written in the 1900s, called The Double System. And he was talking about the double system of justice for white and black in the South. But I think the double system is a good way to think about the way that criminal justice works in this country. I think it's a myth that criminal courts in the United States are an adversary system in which two sides, the prosecution and the defense, supposedly battle it out with equal resources. In fact, it is a bureaucratic system stacked against the 11-plus million people who are arrested every year. Less than 3% of criminal justice personnel work for the defense. And people in that category, I'm including defense lawyers, public defenders, appointed lawyers, probation officers, parole officers. 97% of criminal justice personnel work on the other side. Anybody with money can usually get bail, while the overwhelming majority of defendants who are poor end up doing what is called dead time in jail, awaiting trial and eventually pleading guilty rather than doing more time. Justice serves best those with the best lawyers, and jury trials are very, very rare. Working class youth, meanwhile, get juvie, while middle class youth get psychologists and private schools for the same offenses, and so on. So there's hundreds of examples of the way the double system works once you get inside the criminal justice system. So if the criminal justice system is not involved in dispensing justice or really controlling crime, then what is its mission? A wide and deep history, I think, provides insights to this question. Criminal justice institutions and a whole set of related institutions that make up what I call the carceral state have always played a critical role in preserving and reproducing inequality and enforcing injustices. In addition to public police and guards, many other state agencies are involved. Private police, by the way, private police are much larger than public police in terms of numbers, do a lot, most of the same things that public police do, are pretty much unregulated and never come into the discourse about what should we do about the cops. National security agencies that play a critical role in defining, you know, who are the terrorists, who are the threats, who are the dangerous people. Teachers, public health workers, social workers, politicians and reformers have all been involved in the work of criminal justice in a very expanded way of thinking about what that is. In a society of enormous wealth and extraordinary inequality, you can take steps to reduce inequality and injustice, or you can beef up a muscular system of control to keep things as they are. The United States consistently takes the second choice. I make the case in my book that criminalization through arrest, processing, and incarceration is only one of many ways that coercive power and social control are exercised. Consider, for example, today, the arrest, punishment, and deportation of millions of people without due process. And I say without due process because obviously if you're going to go through a deportation hearing, you have a right to a lawyer, but the government doesn't have an obligation to provide you with a lawyer. So if you don't have money for a lawyer, or if the nonprofit foundations and agencies that are providing legal advice to you are beleaguered, which they are, and stretched very thin, it's very, very hard to get good legal representation. Today, batches of immigrants are tried together, often by video in their detention centers, with hearings taking a matter of minutes. More were deported under Obama than all previous presidents combined. Trump, I think, makes a big deal of his wall because he's trying to furiously out-tough Obama on deportation issues, and that is not an easy thing to do. Or consider, for example, how city governments like San Francisco invoke the use of civility codes to sweep encampments off the streets or banish people from public housing without trial. These are examples of the way in which social control operations take place in sort of a routine way without going through the normal criminal justice process. Or consider how the public welfare system, with its surveillance practices and daily humiliations, treats poor women and children in the same way that police and jails treat poor men. Since the Clinton administration purged millions of poor families from the welfare rolls, the public welfare system, not the middle-class welfare system, the public welfare system, now treats people on public welfare as though they are inherently criminal and not to be trusted. Consider also the many historical examples of how the carceral state has been mobilized against whole populations on the basis of who they are, not what they did or do. People who are treated as politically dangerous or economically exploitable or expendable, and then criminalized. So, First, operations are against a set of people on the basis of who they are, not what they do, and then the criminalization takes place after that. So consider, for example, African Americans in the South after the defeat of Reconstruction, and Native Americans in the West in the wake of our genocide, arrested and punished with forced labor on the basis of being unemployed, not committing crimes, of being unemployed, rounded up to fill labor shortages, with African Americans in the South worked to death in extraordinary numbers, sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50% of the population in a particular workplace, while Native American women and children were sold to farms, ranches, and wealthy families. It was like a slave system in California when California first became a state. Consider also another example how during World War I, 30,000 women who had been accused of infecting conscripts with venereal disease were incarcerated, just picked up, round up, and put in special detention operations, while the men got treatment and entertainment. Or in the same time during World War I, consider the persecution of thousands of Jehovah's Witnesses and their children for refusing to pledge allegiance. Consider, too, the incarceration without trial of 120,000 persons of Japanese origins during World War II, for which finally the government under Ronald Reagan issued an apology and a small amount of money. But less known, followed by the after the war by witch hunts against gay men. This came from federal guidelines about rooting out men who were gay. They didn't think that women could be gay, so it was primarily aimed at men. Rooting out men who were gay, when interviewing men for federal jobs, making sure that they didn't have a gay sexual history, this then infected the way the police operated at the local level, because then you have the cops in all the major cities raiding gay bars and places where people hung out and so on. And there was a study done in the early 1960s asking gay men about what kinds of run-ins they'd had with the cops. And one-third of the people interviewed, one-third of the gay men population, said that they'd had really hard times dealing with cops and cops coming after them and harassing them and so on, which is comparable to the reports that we get on what happens to young African-American men today in terms of being harassed by the police. Or consider the roundup and compulsory registration of Muslim men after 9/11 in the name of fighting terrorism, while about three-quarters of all violent acts and killings in the United States committed for political reasons are done by white right-wing extremists who are not required to register. And consider the long-standing and continuing demonization of African-American men from the decades-long campaign of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI to Trump's view of black and brown people as criminogenic and animal-like. One of the phrases that he's used in the past is to talk about young people who engage in crimes as being a wolf pack, that kind of animalistic imagery to show that they're sort of at a different level of humanity than the rest of us. Consider also all the so-called criminal justice reforms that widened the net of social control and used all the power of criminal justice without the niceties of due process. I'll give you some examples of this. Beginning in the early 20th century through the 1960s, in the name of saving children, educators, social workers, public health personnel, and reformers joined to send without trial thousands of urban immigrant children to military-style reformatories, while thousands of native children were forced into boarding schools where they were punished for speaking Indian. By the 1970s, about 1 million youth were imprisoned annually without due process, of whom 44% were African American. Or another example, in the name of protecting motherhood and public health, the eugenics movement forced some 60,000 young women to be sterilized for the flimsiest of reasons before World War II, because they were sexually active, because they'd had too much children, because they were considered to be mentally deficient in some ways, and they were rounded up and put in institutions, and one of the conditions for them to be released is that they or their guardians would agree for them to be sterilized. And after the war, public health agencies tricked hundreds of thousands of women, mostly women of color, into being sterilized as a condition of getting welfare. So what about the present? The Trump administration, as we know, has pretty much sidelined the language of reform. That's not really been a part of what we've seen coming from the administration around crime and law and order issues. There are recent bipartisan efforts supported by Trump in Congress. The First Step Act might benefit about 1% of prisoners throughout the country. But keep an eye on it. It's not gone into practice yet because of the shutdown. And when it does, keep an eye on one of its provisions, which is to release people and put them under electronic monitoring and shackling in their home communities. So one thing I would look out for and be aware of is not so much that we're reducing incarceration, but shifting some incarceration into people's homes and communities through using electronic devices. There's a great deal that's familiar and old in Trump's law and order, and there's some things that are disturbingly new. Let me try to summarize them. The racialization of crime is very old. This, Trump's demonization of Mexicans echoes, for example, early 20th century campaigns against Latinos as druggies. Like one of the first campaigns against marijuana was linking the marijuana crisis to Mexican immigrants and to the use of marijuana. African Americans in the early part of the 20th century were linked particularly with cocaine use and using cocaine then to attack and rape white women. That was part of the whole fear-mongering about African Americans and equality in the early 20th century. But there's also, not just Trump, there's also a long tradition of bipartisan law and order politics going back to, I think, the Johnson administration. Many of you are familiar and might remember the Kerner Report, which came out in 1968, a very famous public report which talked about the United States now being one nation divided into two, black and white, separate and unequal. It was a very powerful statement. It mobilized a lot of people to try to do things about racism and about civil rights and support civil rights and so on. But there are chapters at the back of the Kerner Report that go into provide detailed information on how police departments need to beef up their riot control, how they need more technology, they need more weapons, they should be trained how to be sharp shooters and so on. That last part of the Kerner Report is the part that really, I think, got implemented as opposed to breaking down the walls of racism. And that tends to be forgotten. There seems to be a certain romantic nostalgia for the good old days of the Johnson administration. But Johnson, in many ways, was a hardline law and order man. And it may have been Nixon who first made law and order such a successful campaign issue in the late 60s, but it was Bill Clinton, the Democrat, who pushed the Democrats to emulate the Republican right and take the low road to demagoguery. He cut 3 million families off welfare. He endorsed the death penalty. He expanded the prison system. I noticed recently Joe Biden has been making apologies for that. Have you seen that? In sort of preparation for his, I guess, for his run for the presidency. I'm sorry what we did. I'm sorry about the law and order aspects of the Democratic Party. And he said something like, we all thought this would, control the crack epidemic. But everybody knows that the crack epidemic was an excuse for certain kinds of policing and enforcement. Had very little to do with the actual drug itself. So it's the same old in terms of the police. The police still kill 3 days with impunity. We're still number one in incarceration in the world. And Obama's immigration policies pretty much continue as they were under him. There's not much difference except maybe the rhetoric around immigration policies and the fact that ICE has now got much more of a free hand in terms of rounding people up, and also that people are much more fearful about being deported. But it would be wrong to see those policies as originating with Trump. There's also some disturbing new developments. So for those of you wishing or hoping for an impeachment of Trump, be careful about what you wish for. Pence is Trump's go-to man around criminal justice issues, and Pence would be the new president of the United States. And with Pence, we're seeing a packing of the appellate courts with right-wingers, very effective, very active, a packing that's not taken place since maybe back to the Nixon days. Also, the new administration is giving a green light signal to the police. In fact, in one famous speech, Trump said to the police, it's fine to rough up people, you know, if that's what it takes to take care of them. I mean, previously, the Obama administration, when Holder was the attorney general, there were police task force, there were public debates, there were the federal government tried to at least restrain police departments like Oakland by putting in certain conditions that they had to meet and so on. So all that is gone. I don't don't think much changed under the Obama administration, but there were certainly political efforts to try to do that. And there was enormous pressure from below. You know, Black Lives Matters and other political movements were pressuring the Obama administration to be more progressive on these issues. There certainly was a discourse about police reform then. The reform of the police has pretty much disappeared as a national political issue. No national politicians are really talking about it. And whatever Attorney General Trump ends up with, he instructs them to take a hands-off approach to police violence. Also, at the state level, the right has been very active and very successful in pushing for certain kinds of legislation, particularly in states that Trump won. So we see all kinds of attacks on reproductive rights and the right to abortion, preparing the way for a case before the Supreme Court. And there's good reason to worry about what the Supreme Court will do. There's a lot of backing of the NRA. We know there's been a lot of protests against the NRA, and a former Supreme Court justice even wrote an op-ed in the New York Times calling for the abolition of the Second Amendment, which was pretty astonishing. But meanwhile, at the grassroots, a lot of pro-NRA legislation is being passed. And the other thing that's taken place, I think, under the Trump administration is that they've given political space and encouragement to neo-fascist groups and organizations that now feel that they can do things with impunity and say things with impunity that before they had to be much more careful about. So this is a moment of dangerous authoritarian disorder, I would say, but it's not a time to give up. Facing it, bringing this thing out into the light, as the civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer used to say, is a necessary first step. So let me be clear. I don't think we're living under fascism. Not yet, anyway. And I still think there are plenty of fissures in the political system. There's still space to develop a vision of equality, justice, and fairness, and of a society that does not need to operate like a garrison state. And we know from the experience of activists in the United States going back at least a century, and from other countries in the United Nations, what would be a humane and sensible way to run criminal justice institutions. This country has a very poor record of learning from other countries, but a long record of trying to impose our ideas and policies around the world, from what was called the water cure in the Philippines in the 1900s to what became waterboarding in Abu Ghraib a century later. Until we become a civilized country ourselves, we should put a stop to being in the criminal justice export business. The problem of what to do is not a problem of a lack of knowledge. To align ourselves with best practices, we should consider many things that are being proposed in other countries by activists in these countries, that you go and talk to experts in the field and they will tell you these are the things we need to do. Some of the things that I particularly like is I think we should consider transferring most of what the police do to public service agencies. There's an important book out by Alex Vitale called The End of Policing, which makes this and some related arguments. I mean, if you look at what the police do on a daily basis, they spend an incredible amount of time policing the homeless, picking up people on the streets, dealing with the mentally ill, taking them to jail. I mean, it's a massive amount of time that's involved in that work, directing traffic. If you think about what the police do in terms of serious crime, it's a very, very small part of their work. So I think we should be considering removing a lot of what the police do to other public service agencies and have them focus only on serious crime. I'd like to see us recruit police who are more like the Peace Corps than Marines. I'd like to see the police put under democratic governance, something this country has never tried. We've never had a democratically governed police departments. I think we should get rid of cash bail, a policy that would drastically reduce the jail population. It's inherently discriminatory. We should get the mentally ill out of jail. Some people think that Los Angeles County Jail is the largest mental hospital in the United States. I mean, the conditions are horrendous, and jails in particular are incubators of disease, including mental illness. We should drastically reduce the prison population, get it in line with other civilized countries in the world, making incarceration a last resort for the very few. Replace most incarceration with mediation through principles of restorative justice. Abolish the barbarity of capital punishment and solitary confinement. There isn't one country comparable to the United States that still has capital punishment. And the United Nations has standards for solitary confinement that says that having people in solitary confinement beyond 14 days, you have a risk of mental illness occurring. I know people that have done 30 years in solitary confinement. make prisons into places of renewal rather than degradation, and restore the civil rights of the formerly incarcerated, including the right to vote, or giving them the right to vote when they're inside. Why not? And create for the first time a decent welfare system that benefits all impoverished communities, including those who have done time, making welfare into a dignified right rather than a right of degradation.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Oh, yes. And we might get some serious prison reform if we convict and send to prison a few thousand corporate and government criminals. The few that do go to prison come out like just preaching reform. It's quite amazing what that does. So these are not new ideas and proposals. Activists and organizations have fought for them for at least 100 years in this country. Here's a quote from Eugene Debs writing about his experience in prison in the 1920s. He said, "The guard and the inmate cease to be human beings when they meet in prison." I think that's a profoundly insightful statement to make about what the institution not just does to the prisoners, but also does to the guards. And he came up with a whole elaborate plan of having spent a lot of time in prison about what should be done. And he offered to put those ideas into practice and would work on it for free, and nobody took him up on it. So many groups have been trying to institute different kinds of reforms, but I think the right and the bipartisan political system, maybe it's going to change in the present, we'll see, but the right and the bipartisan political system have been much more effective in both articulating a vision that resonates in people's insecurities and in fashioning concrete policies. It's not just a matter of coming up with certain policies, it's a way of speaking to people. So, you know, if you think to yourself, what does the right stand for? What do they propose, or what do they conjure up when they talk about crime, law and order, tough police, unshackle the police, make sure that prisons aren't country clubs, keep capital punishment because it stops people doing, you know, more murders, make sure that people's conditions inside prisons are worse than the worst conditions outside. I mean, they have a whole worldview. They have a whole articulated worldview that I could speak very quickly. But if you think to yourself about what is sort of the prevailing discourse about law and order, you can probably conjure it up and talk about it because it's been so successfully promulgated. It really speaks to people. And so it's not just a set of policies. It's a set of ideas that have been so powerful. It will take a comparable progressive movement to build unity among what James Baldwin called the sorrow of the disconnected. Our challenge is to build a social and political movement that seeks to bridge the divide, and it's a huge divide, between anti-police activists, gun reform activists, Me Too activists, mass incarceration activists, immigration activists, and welfare activists. It will take this kind of coalition building, a revitalized imagination, and reckoning with a historical legacy that bleeds into the present to make the criminalized human again and end the tragedy of the punitive state. Beyond these walls, walls that contain millions of our brothers and sisters, walls that divide us, walls that partition our ideas, and walls that cut us off from the past, sweet freedom still faintly calls. Thank you.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Tony Platt speaking about rethinking crime and punishment in America, Beyond These Walls, his book. So it's time for questions. Who would like to ask the first question?
That was a great talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
The point you made about the police spending a lot of time dealing with the homeless and social services also applies to the fire department in San Francisco. Do you know of any cities where they have made this move and change the police's daily objectives and their directions, and has it worked? Has anybody had the nerve to do it?
That's easy to answer, since the answer is no.
No.
So, but I'd say that it's only in the last 10 years that this has begun to be an idea, not just about, there's been lots of debates about how do you stop the police, you know, exceeding their legal duties, how do you stop them being violent, how do you stop them shooting to kill on such a widespread level. There's been a lot of discussion about that, but it's only again now for the first time since the 70s, I think, that there's now a discussion about how the police should be governed and also what should they do. And it's now becoming part of a political debate and discussion, particularly amongst progressive organizations working on these issues. So it's an idea that's out there, and it's an idea that I think is going to grow. And it's a way of also getting beyond a defensive politics, a politics of like we want to stop them doing bad stuff, you know, and thinking about what would a police department look at if it looked like if it was organized and run very differently. And this also speaks to the issue of the fact that the United States has never had a Western-style welfare system. I mean, we had a piece of it in the late 19th century for the families and survivors of the Civil War that got wartime pensions. We had it, of course, in the New Deal, but the New Deal excluded most people of color. Most Latinos were excluded from the New Deal. The two categories of workers that were excluded from the New Deal legislation were domestic workers, maids, and agricultural workers, and that was mostly what African Americans did for work, so they didn't benefit from the New Deal. And then one way of thinking about the war on poverty and the struggles of the civil rights movement is to expand the welfare programs that began to happen in the 60s and early 70s, and then they were cut and broken, and then Clinton really ended it. Clinton ended any possibility of the welfare system being expanded. So often today when we talk about crime and justice and welfare issues, people say, well, we need all kinds of special programs for people returning to their communities from prisons and jails and so on, which we need. But that begs the larger question of the fact that we don't have a dignified, humane, reasonable welfare system for all people, including people that get out of prison. So it worries me that there's a focus now in some people calling for reforms to focus only on prisoners returning. We do need programs for them. Obviously, it's very, very important. But I think that obscures the larger question of why don't we have a decent welfare system. So one way we could get a decent welfare system is to take away a lot of what the cops do and give it to public health workers and social workers and community-based organizations.
Thank you very much for an extremely broad, extremely deep, and well-researched piece of work.
Thank you.
As you're cruising along, I'm trying to take notes. I can't keep up with you.
Read the book.
That's certainly a sales pitch for sure. I'm interested if you kept score for yourself at time equals zero, at time equals the book's finished. I mean, how long did it take to assemble all of these facts? Thank you.
Yeah. I started thinking about these issues when I taught at Berkeley in the 1960s and early 1970s in what at the time was the largest and most important school of criminology in the United States. It was a very exciting time because the School of Criminology, we had a doctoral program, we had a master's program, a large undergraduate program, and it was very pluralistic. There were conservative sort of law and order types, there were liberal, New Deal, war on poverty types, and then there was also a wing of radical activists and radical theorists. It was lively, it was argumentative. It's what a university should be and really is, you know, a place where there are arguments that take place. So it was Ronald Reagan and the Regents that closed down that whole program in the early 70s, probably because we were having too much of an interesting argument and trying to have the kinds of debates that I'm trying to do here today. One of the key people that was involved in the advisory committee in closing down the program and that worked with the administration at Berkeley was Edwin Meese. At that time, he'd come from being a prosecutor in Alameda. He was then Ronald Reagan's right-hand aide and when he was governor. And then when Reagan became president, he moved to become the attorney general. And then he lost his job as attorney general for ethical lapses, I think is the polite term for it. And he went to the Heritage Foundation, which is a very important right-wing think tank, where he influenced major shifts to the right in criminal justice policy in the 1980s. And then it was in the 1980s that when Donald Trump first began to think is probably an overstatement here, but to talk about crime and justice. And it was Edwin Meese and the Heritage Foundation. He cribbed from their ideas for one of his early books when he was beginning to think about a political campaign. And then when he became president, Edwin Meese was in his transition team. As Trump was becoming president. So, the long answer here is that I started thinking about these issues when there was when there were debates and when the university provided space for us to have these conversations then, that got closed down. And then not only did law and order take place throughout the United States in terms of Nixon and after Nixon, but also it took place in the university too. Those kind of debates that we were trying to have in the 60s and 70s were pretty much closed down. Criminology is very tied to operations of the state and government. So I began to become very excited and encouraged by the movements of about 7 or 8 years ago that began, all these grassroots movements starting out again, and young academics also being activists, and Black Lives Matters, and all these debates now being a part of a national debate. And I thought, this is a very optimistic moment. This would be a good time to try to write a book and try to make this book available to people who are trying to think about what to do. And it's not easy to try to figure out what to do, but this hopefully will help people think about how deep these issues are, how difficult they are, and what it's going to take to make changes. So that's where I started. And then, of course, as I started researching and writing it about 4 years ago, then Trump happened. So with the good intellectual projects, you know, you go in, or any kind of creative project, for those of you that do art or poetry or painting or whatever it is, that you sort of start with a plan, but you've got to be open to things changing, you know. Otherwise, it just becomes like a dogma. It's just not very interesting. So the fact that things change politically, I've tried to capture this in this book. Like, what were the changes that took place? What happened when Trump came to power? What's different under Trump administration? What's the same? What's the continuity? And it becomes a different book. It becomes a, you know, not a more... I wouldn't say it's more depressing, but I'm, you know, if you look at the cover of the book, you'll see there's blue sky on the cover of the book, but it's a pretty thin strip of blue sky. And part of what I'm saying is that we need to face the reality of how difficult this is going to be. But I'm hoping this will help people try to fight back in a more thoughtful way.
Thank you. I want to talk about the blue sky a little. There's four examples I'd like to mention to you. The ex-felons in Florida are not going to vote.
Yes, good.
A couple of cops are going to prison for manslaughter.
Yes.
Ex-Governor Brown has finally demanded DNA testing for Kevin Cooper.
Yes.
And Mumia is finally going to get another trial.
Yes.
Is the blue sky expanding?
Yes, those are very, very important examples. I think the fact that formerly incarcerated felons are going to be voting in Florida, that is a very big deal. If you think about Florida and the next presidential election and think about what happened in the past, that's a huge deal. No, there's an incredible amount of activism going on. I've been very encouraged by what's happening at the grassroots. There are all kinds of blog groups and other groups that are going to read the book and think about the issues in the book and tell me what they think. And there's movement. There's definite movement out there. Difficult, but yes. And I'm glad you brought up those examples. Thank you.
I also wanted to ask a little bit about the blue sky element of this. I was really glad to hear you center immigrant rights as part of this analysis and also mention reproductive rights of women, which are very close. They're under attack and they're very close to being criminalized in this moment. So my question is, what is the hope in this moment for communities who are under threat by this mass incarceration system to see common ground with one another and not simply see it as somebody else's problem, right, until they come for me? It's not my issue.
Right.
What is the hope for that coalition building that you mentioned?
This is a really important issue, and I try to write about it in the last part of the book. I mean, there have been moments in American history where people have crossed out of their own comfort zone or their own issues and united with other people. The battle around trying to stop the horrors of what happened to people who were arrested in the South after the defeat of Reconstruction, that movement then was a movement that also tried to bring together people in the community and people who'd been arrested. At the high point, I think, of the civil rights movement in the 60s and even into the early 70s, there was a sense that people in jail and prison they're us. You know, there but for the grace of God go I. That we're part of a common humanity. I mean, the fact that Martin Luther King wrote one of his famous pieces from a jail cell made a huge difference. But that movement, if you think about the height of the civil rights movement and when it became a national popular movement with the majority support, we haven't had a movement like that in a long time, majority support, that it didn't make this distinction between people in community and people who were in jails and prisons. There was a lot of continuity there. And so I think it's not, we can't just blame the man for doing this to us. I think there's a part of the history of American progressive movements where we divide ourselves in these different ways that I think make it difficult for us to really fight back. I don't think we'll make substantial change until there is coalition and unities developed and common ground developed between different kinds of social movements. I think one of the deep divides that took place in the 1960s and 70s was between the African-American movements and the feminist movements. African-American movements were pushing for against over-imprisonment, over-incarceration, the fact that too many people were being criminalized and so on. And one important part of the feminist movement was saying, we need to take sexual violence more seriously. We need to understand that rape is not a private matter in the family, that this is a public matter, that we need to go after sexual violence. People need to be arrested in due time. So, that, I mean, there were other many divisions, too, between feminism and anti-racism. But in terms of this field, that was a big divide. Let's bust them and send them to prison. Let's get them out of prison. Let's reduce the prison population. And that kind of divide, I think, has permeated American progressive politics forever. I think it has to do with the fact that we don't have an institutionalized left in the United States. We don't have a socialist party. We don't have a labor party that operates at the national level. Just about every other country comparable to the United States has national political parties that in one way or another represent the labor movement or progressive movement and so on. So one of the things that struck me writing this book is that there's very little continuity in history. You know, when people talk about police violence, they talk about SWAT teams and, you know, the police getting armaments from the military, and that sort of somehow this starts in the 60s and 70s of the police getting more violent. But the police were set up for this kind of combative violence in the late 19th century and all the way through the early 20th century too. So there's a way in which American politics and progressive movement too tends to be ahistorical or anti-historical or not learn from the past, which is one of the reasons why I'm, you know, I've been trying to write and talk about these issues. So the potential is there, but building that trust and that continuity between women's movement, the disability movement, welfare rights movement, the deportation movement. I think until we build that kind of social movement, unity and coalition, it's going to be very hard to make change that makes a substantial difference. We'll make some difference. You know, American history is full of these examples where some folks make gains and other people's lose a lot. You know, for example, you could say that Reconstruction after the Civil War was a high point of African-American rights and progress, which it was. But at that same moment, Native Americans were being destroyed, driven into reservations, their kids taken away from them, women and children being sold into slavery and so on. And we have a long history of that, of, you know, some folks making progress while other folks are getting beaten down. Until we address that, I think it's going to be hard to make the big change that we want.
One of the issues you brought up earlier can be applicable to this as well, because you said people need to have their welfare with dignity. And I think basically, if you decriminalize poverty and race, some of these issues that really have nothing to do with our crimes, that you'll move towards the issue that you're talking about of people being able to work together as well, because you've eliminated so many of the things that people, I mean, people have to have somebody to dump on. That seems to be human society, human history. But if you decriminalize all the things that we do, or so many of the things we do, we could probably find much more common ground. That's a good point, what you made earlier.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And the fact that we have a lull now in welfare rights activism is a concern. I mean, I think that needs to come back. And this divide between those of us that have, you know, middle-class jobs and professors and so on, and think that we have a right to a pension and medical care and dental care and to get tax relief if we own property and so on. We don't think about that as a privilege. We think that that's a right, you know, that comes with having a job. Whereas people on public welfare are sort of humiliated into thinking they're getting something for nothing.
So I wanted to ask if your research touched at all on juvenile incarceration in this country and if your numbers delved into what that actual number is. And also, it seems that mass incarceration in this country is finally getting some real attention. And it doesn't seem that we're talking that much about juvenile incarceration and the harms incarcerating a child, and also the recidivism trap that kids get trapped in. And I recently read that the single biggest indicator of adult incarceration is juvenile incarceration. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that at all.
Yeah, that's a very important topic and something that I've thought about a lot. Actually, my first book was on that topic. I'll say a couple of things. There's an interesting decline in one of the few areas where there's been some kind of decline in incarceration is around juveniles. This has happened nationwide, and it's happened over the last 20 years. A lot less juveniles being sent to institutions. And I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. When I ask people what's the reason for that, they say that it mostly came out of very successful legal cases, that nonprofit foundations did big cases against states for constitutional violations of young people's rights in institutions. And those were very effective. And so there was a huge decline in the number of people going to institutions. The ones that remain, though, are still disproportionately black and brown and impoverished. And the other thing that's taking place, which is not such good news, is that the people that don't end up in the juvenile system, but they're, you know, they're 17, 18, 19, and so on, the ones in places like Ferguson, Missouri, the ones that are being rousted on the street, you know, those figures that I gave you about the millions of people that the cops stop in on a daily basis all over the country, all those petty things that happen. And, you know, if we had cops outside there now, and that you had to be searched and you had to answer questions and you had to account for the, you know, the drugs that you have in your purse or in your pocket or whatever you have, you're stopped and then they do a search to see whether you have any traffic tickets outstanding. We could probably bust a few people here today if that would happen. So if that goes on routinely, all the time, you know, that's just part of like what happens day to day, all the time. And, you know, if you're middle class and you have homes or gated communities, you don't need to be on the streets because you have a space where which is your private space. But if you're poor, you use the streets, you use public places. And that's where the cops are constantly in combative mode with you. And there you get picked up on all the small stuff, a traffic ticket that wasn't placed, the barbecue in the wrong place in the front yard, that wasn't a joke, that's a real thing. I mean, there's all kinds of infractions that if the police came to our homes in Berkeley or San Francisco or Marin and did checks to make sure that we're not violating any regulations, we could bust a lot of people there too. It's very easy to find things that people have done that are, you know, you can get busted on. And then you get busted and you get taken down to jail and you might lose a day from work or a day from school, or more likely you lose a week or 2 weeks, or then you get busted and you don't get out because you don't have the bail money. And then whatever you were trying to do in school or a job, that's gone. And that's the place where I think this really starts. It's not as glamorous at looking at, you know, San Quentin and the mass imprisonment places and so on, but that's the places where it begins. And it begins with those police interactions on the street, all that daily small stuff. And then they go to court, and the court cases, you know, last minutes, or if they want to have a trial or they want to try to fight something, then they don't have bail, they can't get out, and they're forced to, you know, plead guilty in order to get out and so on. So I think, yes, a lot of progress with people under 18 in terms of reduction of that population, though I don't know what happens to that population. You know, are they on the streets? Are they in bad shape? Are they out of school? We don't really know the answer to that. But then that slightly older generation, the ones that end up later on in Folsom and San Quentin and other places, that's, I think, where it starts.
Mr. Platt, I want to acknowledge your gravitas. How would you hold accountable the following? Caucasian society, its wealth, that can buy their children's freedom through top lawyers. You mentioned clearly who ends up in prison. People look like me. But there's an element of society, they can buy their way out. So how do you counter that culture in this society? White man's money.
I was playing racquetball today with some friends at Berkeley and the university, and we'd booked a court, but some tall, big white guy was in the court, you know, and we had the court, and one of my partners, who's not white, strange way to put it, but anyway, he's not white. And he says to me, just like, partly as a joke, and he says, why don't you ask him to leave? You're white. And I, you know, it's a conversation we've never had like that, but it was just like, in that moment, it was like, yes, he'll more likely listen to you than me. So I think we've got to be careful about painting sort of a one stroke of what whiteness means. I mean, there's millions of incredibly impoverished people who are white in this country. And rather than, I think for the white middle class, there is an extraordinary amount of privilege that comes from race. But for working people, I tend not to think of it as privilege. I think of whiteness as being sort of one less thing that they have to worry about and hassle. So there's a lot of things that working people and poor people face who are white. Race and the burden of race, which is huge, is like an extra one. I wouldn't necessarily call that a privilege. You know, to be poor and white in this country, I don't think is particularly privileged. And one of the interesting things that I found in researching this book is in the middle of the 19th century, when American penitentiaries really begin to take off in the North and the Midwest, is that the prisoners are majority white, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly immigrants from Europe. And, you know, if you'd gone into a prison, say, in 1880 in California, you'd have found one in five or more of the prisoners were Chinese. But if you'd gone into Pennsylvania prisons and looked at them, you'd find that 20% or more of the prisoners there were immigrants, not just white, but immigrants and so on. So there is that history, you know, and there is that history of and that commonality. The problem in a country of racism is that a lot of people who are white don't understand that history or don't appreciate that history. Though I think if you go back to the civil rights movement, you do see that possibility of that kind of unity happening. So I make a distinction between the 1% and the, you know, the middle class professionals who are well off, the people like me who bought a house in the Bay Area in the 1970s and are now, you know, fortunate to have a house and can walk past the homeless and not see them, you know, not see the misery and poverty that is around us every day. I make a distinction between the 1% and sort of the blind middle class and a lot of other white folks who are struggling. And I think the Trump administration were very effective in tapping into that discontent and playing up the racism of that discontent, which has a long, long history in the United States. But that's also a failure of our movement, that we've not been able to find that common ground.
We have time for one more question.
Private prisons. Is it true that the private prison lobby group is the most powerful in the nation or close to it or the most well-funded? Yeah. And how will private prisons affect the fact of punishment in terms of the terms of the internment of the different criminals?
I was waiting for the private prisons question. I'm surprised it hadn't come up earlier. So I have for those of you that, you know, might read some of the progressive literature on this, and I have a different view of this, and I try to look at it and research it and try to figure out what I thought about this. So I think private prisons are, in the big scheme of things, are pretty inconsequential. And yes, there are people who run private prisons and make obscene profits off doing that, in the same way that people make obscene profits off all kinds of things. But it's pretty small potatoes. So, for example, all the profits made out of private prisons throughout the country amount to about 50% of what the state of California spends on its prisons annually. Okay, just to give you the sense of that. And once you start going into other places where money is being made, private security operations, corporate security operations, the people making the high-tech operations, not just waiting for the state and government to come to them and say, you know, help us speed up our electronic devices or develop more efficient ways. They're actually creating ideas and coming to government and saying, we have something new for you, you know, like the facial recognition camera that you go through when you're in the airport and so on. So I would say anything related to, you know, fighting terrorism, and all law enforcement now tries to make that a priority, even though terrorism is really a minor problem in the United States. But everybody uses the language of that. And then the companies that are creating the electronic systems, the data mining systems and so on, that's where big money is, you know, compared to private prisons is really quite small. And something like maybe 7% of all prisoners in the United States are in private prisons. So I know people want to make the argument that people who run private prisons are profiting off people's misery, which they are. But I think it's mistaken to focus on that as the main target of problem. I know there's a new popular book out by a journalist who went underground into a private prison and wrote sort of an expose of it. But I think that book sort of perpetuates some of the mythology about this, that this is a growing issue, that this is a big problem, that this takes a huge chunk of public money. I don't think it does. I think the other areas are much more consequential. So having said that, do I support private prisons? No. You know, what they do is that they lower standards of care. They don't have unions. They treat people horrendously. Why any county or city would want to contract out to a private prison, I do not know, because then you lose all control over the standards of what goes on there. So I'm no way supportive of them, and I think they're pretty much violate all the humane standards of what a prison or jail should be run like. But on the other hand, I don't think it's a serious it's a serious problem, but there's many other bigger serious problems that we should be focusing on as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was an excellent way to end with the historical and financial perspective that you put all the problems into, because that's really an important part of trying to solve them. So ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 116-year history of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.